Good afternoon, and thank you for being here on what is really much too nice a day to be sitting in a room like this listening to somebody blabber at you. But what can I say after I've said I'm sorry? My name is Dan Traister. I work in the Rare Book and Manuscript Library here at Penn, and it's my pleasure to welcome you on behalf of Carton Rogers, Vice Provost and Director of Libraries, who is standing, arms formidably folded in the back of the room, and also on behalf of quite a surprising number of my other colleagues who should know better but seem to be here anyway. It's always something of a surprise. I want particularly to draw attention to Jack and Barbara Sosiak, whose collection has given us the occasion for this event and whose generosity has made it possible for students, for faculty, for visitors to this library to take a look at what I think those of you who have not yet seen the show will agree when you do see it is one of the physically most lovely exhibitions we've mounted in the now 135 years that I've been working here. It is a show which has an enormous amount of just sheer gorgeousness to recommend it. But one of the things that I'm going to be trying to say this afternoon is that it has some other things to recommend it as well. And I hope those will become clear as you take a look at what it is I'm going to be talking about without the examples in front of us and which you will be seeing later on downstairs. I also have to thank, fanning herself agilely in the back of the room, Andrea Gottschalk, who's the designer and mounter of this show. And while it is true that materials as lovely as those you're going to be seeing do have an ability to speak for themselves, it also helps when they're mounted by somebody who has a design sense, which I don't have, but I know enough to see something good and to recognize it when I do. And this is a show that's been very well put up as well. So I need to thank not only Jack and Barbara for their astonishing generosity, but also Andrea for the skill with which those city views have been put up for us to take a look at. Jack is going to be speaking a bit about these maps himself downstairs, and if he wants to kibitz, we also have here Professor Larry Silver, an art historian who works, amongst other topics, on prints in the early modern period. And at any point, which is unfortunately quite likely to occur, when I say something completely misleading, he's probably going to leap in screaming. Politely, of course, because we're an Ivy League institution. The last time we did anything like this, I spoke, and on that occasion extemporaneously, about the value, if there is any, of physical books in the age of Google. And today is clearly a follow-up to that earlier occasion. Why might we want to be interested in, why might we want to worry about bad old physical printed images of places, city views, or maps? In an age when finding our way around, thanks to MapQuest, to Google Maps, and to a host of similar other online tools, just isn't an issue. I should point out that though last time I did this, I spoke extemporaneously because I, in fact, know less about images than I know about printed books. I do have notes in front of me, but while that ties me to the podium, I've been told that I have to stand here anyway for sound purposes. So I'm not going to be jumping around and leaping around as I'm sometimes wont to do in public occasions like this. You can consider yourself spared, ordinarily quite horrible sight. I want to begin all of this discussion of the images that you're about to see by bringing to bear what is not a notion that I think is commonly brought to bear on occasions like this, and that's the notion of fun. We all know that we are partakers of a Puritan legacy that Mencken once defined as the fear that somewhere, someone is having a good time. We tend to have no time for fun as a result. We regard it as a dirty three-letter word signifying essentially intellectual disreputability. I can only say that I don't. Old maps are fun. If you haven't yet seen the city views that you're going to be seeing downstairs, you will instantly discover what I mean when I say that. And perhaps even more to the point, they're also, although this need not be any more reputable than fun itself, aesthetically pleasing. You might even say of some of them that they're beautiful. So what? Does their beauty matter in the age of mechanical reproduction? What do we need to see the kinds of maps that Jack puts on his walls and that Barbara and he have allowed to come to our walls? What good are they at all? Why do we need to see the originals? And what is an original when we're looking at printed, more or less mass-reproduced objects anyway? Right off the bat, I'm going to point out something so obvious that we tend not to think about it at all. That's a question you can't ask of a computer screen, because it's never a question. You're always looking at a computer screen. Whatever is on that screen is something that is mediated for you by the medium through which you see it. The only mediation between you and the Sosiak maps is going to be glass. And that's there because we need to keep them safe from marauding students who were once you some years ago. Occasionally, I teach classes here in literature. When I do, I often include poetry, even though my students, and perhaps you when you were students, fear poetry. It can seem hard to read. Its language is highly condensed and full of images, some of them recondite, and many obscure references. I suggest to my students that one way to think about poems is as if they were little machines. Like machines, poems have what we might call a slew of moving parts. These can include rhyme, funny or standard line breaks or no line breaks at all, weird or common images, obscure or common references, names of people, alliteration, onomatopoeia, other unusual sound patterns, and a vast repertory of possible rhetorical techniques. Why think about, why speak about poems as machines? I suggest to my students that they think about them in that way because machines do work. And they might want to think about a poem as doing a kind of work as well. What's its function? What's its product if we regard it as a little machine? And one of the things I try to suggest to them is that they think about a poem as existing, as being a little machine that exists in order to produce something for us to think about. That's one of the things that images do too. It's not the only thing. It's not even the only thing that poems do. But it is a way to start. You look at an image, particularly the kinds of images that the Sosiak City Views present to us, and you have to think as you look at it, excuse me, what does the world look like? What did the world look like to a person in the 16th or 17th or 18th centuries who might never have been as far as 10 miles outside Poitiers or Utrecht or Winchester? What does that person think he or she is looking at, looking at one of these city views? What's the function for such a viewer of a city view that is presented from on high, that is, in bird's eye perspective? I suspect there is nobody in this room who hasn't been in an airplane. We know what bird's eye perspective is because we've experienced it. These are maps that are produced before hot air balloons, let alone airplanes. How are they getting bird's eye perspective? What do they think they're seeing? Is it real? Is it imagined? Is it a geometrical construct? What are they looking at? How do they understand what they're looking at? We know a bird's eye perspective automatically. They don't. Is it a different function when the city is viewed in line of sight? A silhouette perspective. Thanks, Lynn. What kind of difference do the techniques that the image is produced from make? How sensitive is a contemporary, how sensitive are we, to the differences between something that's produced by engraving, by etching, in later periods by lithography, or by any combination of these techniques? Do those differences affect meaning? What is the meaning? What can we say is the meaning of a city view or map, particularly for somebody looking at a city that he or she has never actually visited? What does it mean for us when we look at a book about a city we've never seen? And can it be the same thing for us when we can imagine actually going there versus an audience for which the thought of going to such a city might be literally inconceivable? When we're looking at a city view, when we're looking at a map from an older period, how can its meaning, how can its content, how can what it says about the place it purports to represent be imagined as meaning the same thing to us now as it meant to them then? And how would we begin to know, how would we begin to think about what the differences are? In printed books from the hand press period, we know that even copies of the same edition may, and often do, differ substantially from one another. Is this also true of images? If it is true of images, how then can we imagine their readers, the people looking at them then, using and treating them? And one example for what kinds of problems we need to think about when we look at such images is color. Because these images are hand-colored, not like the images produced today, which are mechanically colored, in the process of being printed. Different copies look different from one another. There is no basic original copy that's the right one to digitize. The choice of a copy to digitize is almost literally the copy you have in hand to make the digital copy of, and it may or may not be representative of other copies. It may, in fact, be very different from almost every other copy. How would you know? Looking at it on a computer screen, the screen itself, like all reproductive processes, changes colors too. When you're looking at a screened image, are you seeing something that is in fact a replica, even of the idiosyncratic copy you have in front of you, if it happens to be the idiosyncratic copy? Is it an exact replica of the typical copy you have in front of you? And how would you know that from the one digitized image you're looking at on screen? Colors sometimes fade. We can imagine easily having a copy of an image where the colors that have been produced by hand have also faded over time, not knowing that they've faded. It's not always obvious or simply changed over the course of time. Let me give you, and I owe this and indeed much of this discussion to my colleague Lynn Farrington, an example from an entirely different field. Any one of us who's walked through the Greek and Roman sections of a museum knows that ancient Greek and Roman statues were either white or the color of the marble they were chiseled from, because that's how we see them in those museums. In fact, that's not true. They were originally painted, many of them, bright colors, quite foreign to our taste, and also quite unclassical, although that judgment simply shows what we don't know about what was classical. The screen that we look at an image through represents and simultaneously misrepresents and gives us, as a result, sometimes the right thing and sometimes the wrong thing to think about when we're considering the little machine, if you'll allow me to continue with that image, that we're looking at or think we're looking at. Even matters of detail may or may not come through on a screen. Just yesterday, a Penn professor asked Jack Sosiak for permission to use a detail from his Brown and Hogenberg map of Paris, two islands at the tip of the Ile de la Cité were deleted from the map of Paris after the Pont Neuf was built. But Brown and Hogenberg keep it there. Maybe you could see this from a screened image of the map. But looking at the original version does make such things a lot easier if one is trying to trace changes over time. And if Abby Warburg was right that God is in the details, then anything that lets us get close to an object in ways that screens don't always permit us to do gives us an advantage. Also, objects, in ways that are not true of reproduced or screened images of objects, permit us and our students to ask boatloads of questions about them that screens sometimes obscure. What difference, for example, does size make? I should point out here that for those of you who didn't see it, Professor Silver had an exhibit at the Philadelphia Museum of Art some years ago about extraordinarily large scale early modern prints. I tried to imagine what that would have looked like. I don't know whether the museum ever put it up on the web. I assume it did, but I've never looked at it on the web because I can't for myself imagine what good it would do me to look at those images on the web. Some of these were enormous, and looking at them on a screen is a complete and utter distortion of what those prints are, what they look like, what they feel like, the impression that they give you, and what you can see of them is not going to be something that you can see on a screen. I've looked at a large reproduction of one of the images downstairs in Jack and Barbara's show. It displays large urns, close up and in the background. In both Jack's image and the reproduction, the large foreground urns are pretty clear. The background urn is also clear in Jack's image. In the reproduction, it looks like a large blob, and you can't tell what it is at the back, in the distant back of the view's perspective. It's unidentifiable, and it doesn't function. On screen, in reproduction, can we even see, let alone begin to discuss, differences that arise from production choices, etching, engraving, lithography, combinations, to use X, Y, or Z papers, or colored paper as the base for the print, to add some details by hand after the printing is over? How might our students even begin to know that such questions can be asked about production and its effects, if any, on reception, if we can only see reproduced images that don't in fact reveal those details? Sometimes we can't even tell from an image of an image whether a map was intended for a luxury or a common audience, something that sometimes can be determined literally by feeling the thickness of the paper on which the map or another form of image appears. Part of the purpose of an education is to get students, and sometimes even their instructors, to think about what seems obvious but isn't. If originals have the power to encourage that sort of questioning and that sort of wonder, then it turns out that part of the function, part of the work of what I've called these little machines, poems or images, is to be a very powerful pedagogical tool. And if that hasn't bored the pants off you, now is the time to go take a look at these little machines. I'm just going to say very quickly that there are going to be guides to get you back down there, but when you're down there, there are booklets that, typos for which I apologize and all, give you a certain amount of info about the materials in the show. They're limited numbers. Please don't take more than one. But if you have to, nobody's going to notice. Enjoy. And we'll be down there to talk about this.